This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, powered by the Family Research Council, your embassy of faith, family, and freedom in the heart of our nation's capital. Now, here's your host, FRC President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this Wednesday edition, is church going and religious adherence really in widespread decline? So much so that conservative believers should suffer, quote-unquote, growing anxiety, as some claim. One Christian ministry leader says, absolutely not. My friend Glenn Stanton, director of Family Formation Studies at Focus on the Family, joins me in just a moment. And does the American public have a right to know what, if any, crimes or other improprieties were committed by members of the Obama administration and members of the FBI? We'll hear from Virginia Republican Congressman Bob Goodlatte, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, about a four-page classified memo and thousands of text messages that indicate possibly a secret society within the FBI that's resisting Donald Trump. And we're anxiously awaiting the confirmation of Kansas Governor Sam Brownback as ambassador at large for international religious freedom. Kristen Wright, director of advocacy at Open Doors USA, will be here to discuss the importance of U.S. policy that protects religious freedom. And we'll also catch up on New York Times bestselling author Joel Rosenberg, who's in Israel, and get his thoughts about Vice President Mike Pence's recent trip to the Middle East. So we got a full program for you today, so don't miss anything. If you do, well, you can always go back to TonyPerkins.com where it is archived. Everything. If you got to stop and pick up that loaf of milk, that loaf of bread and a jug of milk, well, later on you can listen to it at TonyPerkins.com. Also, information there about our upcoming trip to Israel. If you'd like to join us, former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, General Jerry Boykin, former Ambassador for Human Rights Ken Blackwell, all of that, all those folks are going to be with us. You can join us. Find out more. Go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. And if you're on Twitter, it is at TPerkins. Okay. Some maintain that Christianity is on decline. That has been the narrative of the media. In fact, this goes back for years. But new Harvard research, yes, you heard me right. Harvard research says the Christian faith in the U.S. is not shrinking, but growing stronger. Joining us now is Glenn Stanton, director of Family Formation Studies at Focus on the Family. Glenn also served the George W. Bush administration for many years as a consultant on increasing fatherhood involvement in the Head Start program. And he and I go way back to when actually did the covenant marriage law in Louisiana years and years ago. Glenn, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you, Tony. It's good to talk to you. It's been years, but
it has been.
With an old friend.
It has been. It's great to talk with you. Of course, I've been keeping up with your work, though, through the years, and you continue to do great work. Going back to one of the first books you wrote, Marriage Matters, and I remember using that extensively as we were working on the covenant marriage front back in Louisiana. This interesting column that you have in The Federalist, you write this, that religious faith in America is not going the way of the yellow pages and travel maps that we keep hearing. You know, it's just a matter of time. They're saying that it's just a matter of time until Christianity is totally and happily extinct. And we're hearing this narrative over and over. And your response to that is not so fast.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, what prompted me, and Tony, you're familiar with this article, The Atlantic this month just wrote an absolutely goofy piece on Mike Pence and his faith and how, quote-unquote, weird his faith is when he's just a good run-of-the-mill evangelical guy. And one of the statements in there was that, hey, Christianity is shrinking, it's just a matter of time before it goes away, and that all Christians, especially the Christian right, should be very concerned. Well, it is just absolutely not true. And again, this research, very recent research coming to press at the end of last year, shows us that while mainline Christianity is like hemorrhaging members like crazy, I say they're leaving those buildings like they're on fire, can't get out fast enough, these Harvard scholars say that biblical Christianity, evangelical Christianity, has largely just held constant. It's maintaining itself. It's not shrinking. It's even growing a little bit. But it's the mainline churches that are shrinking, declining. And the churches that teach Scripture, that teach real Christian discipleship, that are faithful to what Christ teaches us, those churches are doing quite well. And it's not even just the Harvard research. I ask in this article in The Federalist, just look at your own churches. If you go to a mainline church, then look at what's happening. If you go to a good Bible-believing church, and we know what those churches are, it's likely that they have numerous services every Sunday morning to deal with the crowds that they have. I mean, those churches are growing. They're doing quite well. And so when we hear these silly statements about, well, Christianity is on the decline and that America is becoming increasingly secularized, a lot of the elites are, but in middle America across the country, no. These scholars say that vibrant faith is persistent in America.
Yeah, you're right in this, that the folks at Pew have been reporting for years that while the mainline churches are in drastic freefall, the groups that show the most significant growth is the non-denominational family. In fact, you state this fact: evangelical churches gain 5 new congregants exiled from the liberal churches for every one they lose for any reason. I mean, you're right. They are leaving the mainline denominations, you know, quicker than Baptists leave a church picnic that's out of fried chicken. I mean, they are heading for the doors. And but here's the point, and I think the media wants to use this, and the left wants to use this to make, I believe, Christians feel like they're isolated and alone. But again, the evidence that is uncovered in this report from Harvard suggests that the opposite is true.
And that's exactly right. And I think, Tony, you nailed it. Is they want people like us to think that our groups are shrinking, that our numbers are shrinking, and that, you know, basically we're going to go the way of the horse and buggy. Where if, and we hear this all the time, if you came down from space, a Martian, you would think that gay and lesbian individuals were just all over the place because of what they see on TV. Well, it is Christianity that is growing, and it's vibrant Christianity. We need to understand, nobody really comes to church, nobody really comes to Christianity looking for what I call 2% Christianity, thinking right about 2% milk. It's they want whole stuff, they want cream, they want the real thing, and teachers, pastors that are teaching the Word of God faithfully, people are voting with their feet and shuffling over to their churches in great numbers. And so the Harvard people will tell us, as far back as we can measure these sorts of things, 50 years back, the evangelical churches, in terms of proportion of the population, are remaining constant. And also, in terms of the proportion of religious people in America, the religious conservatives now make up a larger proportion of all religious people. The progressives, if you will, or the liberal religious people, those people are not growing. They are not growing in influence and sway. It's really people like us, the more conservative folks. And that, indeed, is very, very good news.
Glenn Stanton, my guest. You're listening to Washington Watch. We're talking about a piece that he wrote regarding information out from Harvard, a study that they did looking into Christianity today. And here's one aspect I think that's going to cause some people to run off the road here. So guys, keep your eyes, guys and gals, keep your eyes on the road. Listen to what Glenn's going to say here. Let's go back to the founding of the nation, and let's look at whether or not church attendance and adherence to Christianity has declined or increased.
Yeah, this is Rodney Stark. He is a leading scholar in sociology of religion at Baylor, and has written, I mean, he's just widely, widely respected. And in one of his books, he has a little chart of looking at how church attendance has happened since the colonies. And he says that church attendance has increased every decade since 1776. So we have more church-attending people per capita in the population than we did in, you know, the good old days, if you will, of colonial America in 1776. And so it wasn't bad back then, but what religion has done very clearly and unmistakably in Christianity has continued to increase and increase and increase from those days. We are not growing more secular. We are growing more faithful, if you will, in our commitment to Christianity. And again, our people, believers out there going to church every week, they need to know that the wind is at their backs. This is the movement of more of the population than not. And again, that is good news.
And another aspect of this, Glenn Stanton, is the fact that the United States is different than many of the other nations, where we're seeing what's happening in Europe and the decline of Christianity there. Just because it's happening there, and I know there are some trends we see here in the United States that are troubling, but the evidence suggests that America is not going the way of other nations.
Yeah, that's exactly right. These scholars, they always use these fancy terms, and what they were testing is what they call the secularization thesis, and that is you see the secularization of Europe, and is America following that trend? And so that's what they were actually measuring. And they found no data for that whatsoever, and they said that faith in America remains persistent and remains vital, and that there is no data whatsoever for the secularization thesis, that we as Americans are becoming a more secular people, a more secular nation, that we are really those who take their faith really seriously and teach it and learn it, we are remaining constant. So, no, there is not an increasing secularization in terms of the American people. Now, there's increasing secularization in the schools and in the media and in movies and things like that. But in terms of where all the rest of us live, no, we're not turning more secular.
The point is, genuine Christianity should fill us with hope, because it is not dwindling, it's not dying on the vine. If it is truly connected to the vine, it is living, it is vibrant, and it is bearing fruit. And speaking of fruit, one final point before we run out of time here. Just yesterday, the passage of discussion I had with my kids as we read on a daily Bible study, it was in Psalm 127, where it says, "Behold, children are the heritage of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is his reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth." And that's exactly what this study shows, that faithful people are having more children, and that's one way to impact the growth of Christianity.
And that's exactly right. I mean, fertility really does direct the future. It's not the liberals that are having the kids and raising them well. They're aborting too many of their kids. It's the Christians that are having more kids, raising them well, teaching them well. And this research also tells us that good Bible-believing Christians do a better job at passing on their faith to their children than any other group.
Yeah. Hey, Glenn, we got to leave it there. Fascinating article. I'm going to encourage people to read it. And hey, great to connect with you again.
Absolutely, Tony. Thank you.
Glenn Stanton. Find out more, go to TonyPerkins.com. All right, when we come back, we're going to have the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Congressman Bob Goodlatte. He's going to be with us. I hope you will as well. Don't go away. We're back with more after this.
What does sex trafficking, abortion, and pornography have in common? A lot, as it turns out, and all three are on the rise across the world. Today, almost 45.8 million people live in slavery around the world, and around 4.5 million people are slaves in the sex industry. Those who consume pornography are much more likely to seek women for paid sex, many of whom are victims of sex trafficking. Each click of pornography creates demand for more pornography and brings in a profit to the sex industry. The demand causes traffickers, pimps, and those involved in the sex industry to abuse their victims by filming them in sex acts. To learn more about the link between these issues and to find out how you can help stop it, go to frc.org/traffic. Again, that's frc.org/traffic.
Gender reassignment surgery. Once rare and unusual, it is now becoming more and more common. Across the nation, transgender activists are pushing for this costly, extreme, and unproven procedure to be declared medically necessary so that it can be paid for with taxpayer dollars. The problem for these activists is that the evidence is not on their side. In 2016, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services examined 33 studies on the subject and declared that there was not enough evidence to determine whether gender reassignment surgery improved health outcomes. One study found that those who had undergone gender reassignment surgery showed a suicide rate that was 19 times higher than the general population. Declaring gender reassignment surgery to be medically necessary is not only inaccurate, but dangerous. To view FRC's full report on this important issue, visit frc.org/surgery. Again, that's frc.org/surgery.
Is being right enough to win an election? Many tend to believe that being right, in the sense of being factually correct, is sufficient to win in politics. Unfortunately, political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Arnakis knows how to win. As Senior Director for the Leadership Institute, the nation's premier public policy training organization, he has 15 years of grassroots organizing, campaign, fundraising, and communications experience, and has established himself as one of the country's top political trainers. Hear Mr. Arnakis discuss the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election. Go to frc.org/speakers to view this timely discussion.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Glad to have you along on this Wednesday afternoon. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, Republicans have ramped up their investigations and hearings into the Department of Justice and the FBI amid allegations of anti-Trump activities, including an alleged secret society and thousands of missing text messages. Some are actually calling for a second special counsel to investigate the investigators. Joining us now is Congressman Bob Goodlatte. He represents the 6th Congressional District of Virginia, and he is the chairman of the House Committee on the Judiciary, the second oldest standing committee in Congress. Congressman, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony. It's great to be with you and your listeners.
Well, you've been on top of this, and over the weekend, this past weekend, you combed through thousands of new text messages that were roughly about 9,000 of them that was communications between some FBI agents, and you have raised concerns over what you've seen.
Oh, absolutely. As you know, the first batch that we received back in December, you remember that, was really troubling. Given the discussions about a so-called insurance policy, remember that? The rampant bias against what was then candidate Donald Trump and the lack of professionalism by some high-ranking federal employees. And keep in mind, I think that the Federal Bureau of Investigation is indeed the premier law enforcement organization in the world. They keep us safe. Thousands and thousands of men and women keep us safe every day. They solve crimes. They prevent crimes. They prevent terrorist attacks. They are very important. But several people at the top of this organization, one a counterintelligence agent, another an FBI attorney integral to the investigation, sending massive numbers of text messages on matters large and small, work-related and not, it's just a stunning display of unbelievable bias in favor of one candidate for president against the other. But it's what you are concerned about in terms of what actions may have been done or not done that really has these texts taken in the context of everything else we know about the Hillary Clinton investigation by Director Comey and the FBI, and then the subsequent investigation with Donald Trump gets me even more concerned. And then these new new texts are extremely troubling.
Now, these texts we're talking about, two agents in particular, Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, who were having kind of some relationship outside of the office.
That's right.
The volume of these messages, I mean, we're talking like 50,000. I'm not quite sure how you do that and work at the same time.
It's unbelievable. Yeah, it really is. And I haven't seen anywhere near 50,000, but I have seen thousands. And the new batch, first thing that's really concerning is that we're missing a critical five-month period. And to me, it's inconceivable that this is a coincidence, that these haven't shown up for some technical glitch. These are a critical period of time between when they started at the FBI, the Trump-Russia investigation, and the day before Mr. Mueller was appointed the special counsel. And so this is the work being done before it went over to a special counsel. And by the way, I've supported having a special counsel investigate, and as long as it's unbiased, I want Mr. Mueller to continue his work. But this is about what's going on in the FBI itself at the highest levels, and that's what's very troubling.
So, Chairman, do you see the appointment of a second special counsel to look into this?
Well, you know, I and almost all the other members of the Judiciary Committee a few months back wrote to the Attorney General calling for, and the Deputy Attorney General calling for, the appointment of a second special counsel to handle what was mishandled. And we held hearings in the Judiciary Committee and had Director Comey and others, the former Attorney General Loretta Lynch, come and testify. We were very dissatisfied with how that was handled, both from the standpoint of the decision made, how the decision was announced, and even the subsequent decision a week before the election to announce that they're reopening the investigation. That all of those things do not meet the professional standards of the FBI, and that should trouble Democrats that last-minute reopening took place. So this is about making sure that this very important organization functions properly and fairly and has the trust of the American people.
Maintains its integrity.
Whether somebody did something wrong or not, we want people investigated who may have done something wrong, as long as it is for the purpose of upholding the rule of law and not for the purpose of partisan politics.
Without question. A related topic is, you have expressed concern. In fact, I understand that you and Mr. Gowdy and Nunes are working, going through a process of releasing or seeking to release a four-page memo on the FISA abuses so that the American public can know just how, well, I'd say over the line the previous administration went.
Well, first of all, you're correct. I have read that memo. That memo is the work product of the House Intelligence Committee. And so the desire to make sure the American people knows what's going on in a very serious matter without compromising sources and methods that are very important to intelligence organizations and law enforcement organizations, so that people who are sources of information for not, for example, are not, their lives are not in danger.
Understood.
Needs to be protected. So they can't release the thousands of pages of documents that they have, many of which, again, I've had the opportunity to review because of their classified nature. So this memo is a way to take that, remove all information related to sources and methods, and then make it available to the American people. There's a process for doing that. I'm told it's not been used before, and that is for the Intelligence Committee, which created the document, have a vote of its members.
But, Chairman, we're up against a hard break. We've got to leave it there. Okay. We'll revisit that issue with you, because I hope you're successful. Congressman Goodlatte, thanks so much for being with us. Folks, don't go away. We're back after this with more.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God. But culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay. Is being right enough to win an election? Political history proves otherwise. The candidate who organizes and communicates the best will beat the opposition, no matter how right the other side is. Christians who are running for public office have a moral obligation to study and learn how to win. They must discover the real nature of politics. Robert Ornakis is one of the country's top political trainers. Hear him discuss the real nature of politics and how to overcome the odds to win an election at frc.org/speakers. The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue. If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God. But culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
You are listening to Washington Watch, and I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad that you're with us. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at T Perkins. All right, sadly, many reports of Christian persecution never see the light of day in the mainstream media. But daily, Christians are being killed because of their faith. In fact, it's almost pandemic. The Christian Post reported that a pastor in India who was known for long 5 to 6 hour prayer sessions, his church was growing, people were coming to Christ, he was found beaten, tortured, and hung to death from the rafters of his church by his congregants. This type of activity happens all too often and highlights the importance of having Kansas Governor Sam Brownback as ambassador-at-large for international religious freedom. We've talked about that a lot on this program. In fact, last week dedicated a whole program to religious freedom and a segment of that to international religious freedom. Well, joining us now is Kristen Wright. She serves as the Director of Advocacy at Open Doors USA. Kristen, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Let me start with this simple question. Is the global threat to Christians on the rise or decline?
It's absolutely on the rise globally. Open Doors every year actually releases something called the World Watch List, and this is a list of the 50 countries in the world today where the Christians face the most severe persecution simply because of their faith. And year after year, leading this list is North Korea, but it's followed by Afghanistan and by many other countries where Christians face severe persecution. And I think that, to your point earlier, it has been garnering greater media attention, but that's simply because the problem is getting greater. We're seeing Christians being slaughtered in different places of the world, Christian women and girls being kidnapped in places like Nigeria and in Egypt. And, of course, a lot of us probably listening today are familiar with the situation of Christians in Iraq along the Nineveh Plain. And that's something that this administration has been very eager, a situation that this administration has been very eager to address.
And that speaks to the issue that I think part of the problem we've seen here in the last decade is a lack of American leadership. And I think America absolutely can make a difference on this, not just from a standpoint of our federal government. And as we were talking about Sam Brownback, who was tapped to be ambassador at large for international religious freedom. But churches and the fact that we draw attention to this, speak out on it, support ministries like Open Doors and Voice of the Martyrs and others who are speaking up for the persecuted, we can make a difference.
We absolutely can. I think that the important thing for listeners to know today and is that really every voice matters. As an example of that, just a few weeks ago, right before Christmas actually, I had the privilege and honor of hosting a 13-year-old boy from Iraq, from Karamalesh. It's a small town on the Nineveh Plain in Iraq. I hosted him, his father, and two priests. And together, we were actually able to meet with Vice President Pence in a very, very special meeting. And Noah was able to give him a gift that I'm pretty sure the Vice President will never forget. It was a gift of the marbles that he had found in the burned out, bombed out remains of his bedroom in his home on the Nineveh Plain when his family returned to Karamalesh, which is newly liberated from ISIS. And so the family is now living there. But Noah was able to make this brief trip to the United States to share his story firsthand. And I think that as we contemplate that, I think nothing speaks more poignantly of destroyed or lost childhood than burned marbles. So this is something that's it's a very human issue, and it's something that I think that people from all backgrounds should care deeply about as the increase of Christians and other religious minorities in these areas continues to be on the rise. We need leadership on this issue today more than ever. And so to get to your point on the ambassador at large role, this is a crucial role for the United States to have filled. And this role is the ambassador at large for international religious freedom. And of course, President Trump nominated Governor Brownback from the state of Kansas to be the ambassador at large for international religious freedom. And I have to say, as director of advocacy at Open Doors USA, I was delighted when I found out that he had been nominated for this crucial role because Governor Brownback, in his previous years in the Senate and for many years, has been a tireless advocate for those who are persecuted for their faith.
I can't think of a better choice.
I really, truly couldn't think of a better choice. He's the right guy for the job. The question is, when will he be confirmed? Will that happen? And we're hoping that it's imminent, as early as Friday or perhaps next week. But we are eagerly awaiting that confirmation from the Senate, and we're also urging the Senate to confirm him as soon as possible.
Well, Kristen, we do as well, and thank you for joining us. And again, thanks to you and Dr. Curry for the great work you all do at Open Doors USA.
It's a privilege and an honor to be here. Thank you so much.
All right. Folks, to find out more about the work of Open Doors USA, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. All right. When we come back, the Vice President, Mike Pence, just ended a four-day trip to the Middle East. What can we learn from that trip? Well, when we return, we'll talk with our good friend Joel Rosenberg, New York Times bestselling author, who now lives in Israel and was at the Vice President's speech before the Knesset. We're going to talk with Joel when we return. So don't go away. We're back with more Washington Watch right after this.
What does sex trafficking, abortion, and pornography have in common? A lot, as it turns out, and all three are on the rise across the world. Today, almost 45.8 million people live in slavery around the world, and around 4.5 million people are slaves in the sex industry. Those who consume pornography are much more likely to seek women for paid sex, many of whom are victims of sex trafficking. Each click of pornography creates demand for more pornography and brings in a profit to the sex industry. The demand causes traffickers, pimps, and those involved in the sex industry to abuse their victims by filming them in sex acts. To learn more about the link between these issues and to find out how you can help stop it, go to frc.org/traffic. Again, that's frc.org/traffic.
Gender reassignment surgery. Once rare and unusual, it is now becoming more and more common. Across the nation, transgender activists are pushing for this costly, extreme, and unproven procedure to be declared medically necessary so that it can be paid for with taxpayer dollars. The problem for these activists is that the evidence is not on their side. In 2016, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services examined 33 studies on the subject and declared that there was not enough evidence to determine whether gender reassignment surgery improved health outcomes. One study found that those who had undergone gender reassignment surgery showed a suicide rate that was 19 times higher than the general population. Declaring gender reassignment surgery to be medically necessary is not only inaccurate, but dangerous. To view FRC's full report on this important issue, visit frc.org/surgery. Again, that's frc.org/surgery.
If you had to make a law, where would you start? America's founding fathers determined law from a fixed source, God, but culture has shifted the focus to man's self-determined law. If truth is no longer determined by God, it becomes subjective and open to interpretation. In an incisive new paper, Peter Johnston traces the origins of these dangerous trends in American law and the importance of staying true to our founding principles. To view FRC's new publication, go to frc.org/decay.
The Family Research Council had the pleasure of hosting Dr. Michael Paulson to speak about how Christians can respond to arguments against religious liberty. Dr. Paulson argues that religion is different and deems exemptions within the law. A religious person believes in God, and God's sovereignty requires complete devotion, whereas government only requires allegiance and civil duties. The Constitution itself treats religion differently, giving America religious liberty and the freedom to exercise. Visit frc.org/university to hear more about this issue.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Glad to have you along on this Wednesday afternoon. Vice President Mike Pence wrapped up a four-day Middle Eastern tour with a visit to one of Judaism's holiest sites, the Western Wall. On Monday, the vice president was the first sitting vice president to address Israel's parliament, known as the Knesset. Well, one of our good friends was there. He is, you know him, you've heard him on here many times. He is a New York Times bestselling author of 13 novels, got a new one out, and 5 nonfiction books with nearly 5 million copies in print. And he is now a citizen of Israel. He joins us, Joel Rosenberg. Joel, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Shalom, Tony from Jerusalem. Great to be with you.
Yeah, a little. It's great to have you there. You've had a lot of little activity there in the last few days with the vice president. You were there at the Knesset when he spoke. Give us your thoughts on the vice president's trip there to the Middle East.
Well, you really have to look at it from two different lenses, or maybe three. First is three. How did Israelis see the speech and his visit? How do evangelicals overall see the vice president's speech and visit? And then how do our Arab allies see it? And Israelis, this was a grand slam home run, Tony. Again, it was such an honor, humbling really, to be in the Knesset parliament and to hear the first ever vice president of the United States address the Israeli entire government right there. And since my wife Lynn and I have been friends of Mike and Karen Pence for many years, it was particularly special to see him there making the case. So the Israelis were electrified. I mean, I lost count of how many standing ovations. From the Israeli perspective, it could not have been better. From the evangelical perspective, overall, I think most evangelicals are very excited about the vice president's, not only his speech, which was so well written in so many ways, and had more scriptural allusions and quotes than I honestly think, Tony, any speaker at that podium inside the Israeli parliament has ever used. It's just not part of the discourse here.
But he did it respectfully and very humbly. Not every evangelical, however, is happy. Certainly the Arab believers, Palestinian believers, are not happy. And I think there are American evangelicals who, while they support, of course, Israel's capital being Jerusalem and the embassy moving eventually, they're not sure this is a good time, this right moment. That's the second argument. And then the third one is the Arab neighbors. He went to meet with President El-Sisi in Egypt in the exact same palace, in the exact same room, you and I.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that in a minute, because in many ways he followed our footsteps as we went to both Egypt and met with the president there, and then to Jordan. And so I want to get to that aspect as well, because that was fascinating.
They're not happy. So that's the short way to put it.
Well, let's talk about I think you're absolutely right. I think that's the way the speech is viewed. And you cannot help but look at it in some ways through theological lenses. So I think that affects the way some people see this from
that's
the true. Standpoint of how the church, how Christians are to approach the nation Israel. But let's go to the geopolitical with his first stop with President El-Sisi. That was our first stop in the Middle East when we went over there just 2 months ago. Significant step for the vice president to meet with the president of Egypt.
It was, and particularly now, you and I saw firsthand. We heard directly from the mouth of President Sisi how much he wants to rebuild the Egyptian alliance with the United States. He is fighting radical Islamist terrorism. He is trying to rebuild his economy. And he wants in with a robust American alliance. So, for no senior official, American official at that level or higher, has been to Egypt in more than a decade, and certainly not during President El-Sisi's tenure. No one's come to show him the respect that you're our friend, you're our ally. There's still things we got to work on in terms of disagreements we have, fine, but we are with you, Mr. President. We're with you, Egypt. And that was super important, and I think he did a good job in a very challenging environment because of this Jerusalem controversy.
Well, I think it's important for a couple of reasons. One, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean you saw the same thing I did. I think Egypt is fairly fragile right now, coming off the 7 years of what they've been through, and I think they could fall into the arms of someone else. And so I think it's very important the United States respond to their overtures of wanting a friendship and helping guide them on what I think could be very significant in the Middle East when it comes to religious freedom and respect in Muslim countries.
Absolutely. The fact that President El-Sisi wants this relationship with the United States is so important because, obviously, his predecessor, who was the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, absolutely did not and was a tyrant. So this is good. But he's also, as we met with, about nearly 60 Egyptian Christians, all of whom said, listen, there are challenges. But things are getting better. We're moving in the right direction on religious freedom, human rights. There's a long way to go. They were clear with you and me and our team that they don't want to give a rosy picture, but Sisi is moving the country in the right direction, and he needs to be encouraged and helped. So that was very, very important. And for Vice President Pence to go and personally meet with him and talk about these issues, strategic issues, I think was a very important signal.
Now, prior to the vice president going during the Christmas season, there were attacks again. You and I, we've been continuing our communication with the Egyptian officials there, and there have been attacks on Christians, Coptic churches. But the government, very aggressive in dispatching police, military to protect them. Is that a part of building those overtures to say, look, we're serious. We're putting action to our words.
Absolutely. One of the things that struck me about meeting with President El-Sisi was in that nearly three-hour meeting. It's still amazing to me that he, while we did not deserve it, he treated our visit like we were heads of state, that much time and attention that he gave us. One of the things he made clear was he doesn't see Egyptians as Muslims or Christians or other minorities. You're Egyptian. And he wants to treat everybody equally. That has not been the policy of Egypt for, I don't know, ever. So that alone, you know, that he's saying we're going to dispatch whatever amount of force is necessary to protect every person in our society. And since Christians are being targeted by the Islamic State, the Muslim Brotherhood, and others, then we'll protect their churches during Christmas and New Year's. And again, there are many steps that have to still be taken to protect Christians and give them their full freedom. But we really walked away feeling and hearing from people that they are moving in the right direction for the first time in who knows when. So we need to encourage people who need to be encouraged and honor, give honor to those whom honor is due. And I think that is the case with President Sisi.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Glad to have you along. My guest, Joel Rosenberg, he is calling us. We're talking to him from Israel. He was at the Knesset for Vice President Mike Pence's historic speech to the Israeli parliament. Let me shift over to his second stop. That was Jordan. We also met with King Abdullah. And what significant things came out of that meeting?
Yeah, that was even more sensitive than the one with the Egyptians. The Egyptian government was not happy with the Jerusalem decision, but King Abdullah is in a different situation. Jordan has, in its peace treaty with Israel, custodianship of the Temple Mount, of the Dome of the Rock, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the very holy sites in Islam, and so that's a sensitive issue. It's his father who's, you know, from whom Israel captured, or in the view of Israel, liberated, you know, Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria, known as West Bank. So it's still a very sensitive issue, the Palestinian issue. 70% of the Jordanian people, approximately, are Palestinian. So the king has a treaty with Israel. He too, has a strong relationship with the United States and wants that. He is a man of peace. We saw that. We know that. But he also has a population that is enraged by the fact that they didn't listen to President Trump's speech. They didn't get the nuances. What they heard is Trump gives Jerusalem to the Jews. And even though President Trump said, look, the exact boundaries of Jerusalem are still to be determined by final negotiations between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and the status quo of the holy sites will be protected. So those are important elements in what the president said on December 6th. And what Vice President Pence reiterated in each of his meetings. But the king, you know, he's got a perspective, and it's different from the American position. And I saw in watching the video of King Abdullah and Vice President Pence and their teams having lunch together in the same room where you and I had lunch with the king and our team did, I saw two friends and allies having a very candid conversation on things they disagreed about, but keeping in mind the big picture, which is we are friends, we are allies, we do want and need to work closely together, so let's not let this derail us, but we have to be honest about where we're coming from. And I think that's healthy, but it is very sensitive.
Joel, an issue that I didn't necessarily see connected in the press, but the timing of it, there was a very sensitive diplomatic issue between Jordan and Israel regarding an Israeli security guard at the Israeli embassy compound that shot and killed two Jordanians. That's been an issue for 6 months. That was resolved around the same time with an apology from Israel, and now formal diplomatic relations are reestablished. Connection?
Yes, I believe so. The Prime Minister of Israel, Prime Minister Netanyahu, actually said publicly that he thanked Jason Greenblatt and Jared Kushner, the president's top two Middle East advisors, thank them for their personal, I don't want to say intervention, but assistance in helping Jordan and Israel iron out differences over a very sticky situation that we discussed very off the record. So I don't want, you know, with the king and his team, so we can't speak about that. But we knew that it was cooking. We knew that it was a sensitive issue where Israel had no diplomatic contact, didn't have an ambassador in Jordan anymore because of this incident that happened. But things are back on track, and that's healthy. And I'm very glad that it preceded the vice president's visit. I suspect, but I don't know this for sure, but I suspect part of it was you boys get this figured, you know, no, I shouldn't say it that way, but you two countries get this thing figured out so it's not on the table when the vice president arrives.
Joel Rosenberg, as always, great to talk with you. Thanks for joining us this afternoon, my friend.
My pleasure. Great to be with you from Jerusalem.
All right. I hope to see you in, I know I'll be talking to you before, but hope to see you in April when we're over there. All right, folks, and you can join us. Find out more, go to the website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, almost out of time. Not going to be able to take phone calls today, but I want to encourage you. Last night, I was on CNN discussing the issue, the latest allegation of the president, something he did 10 years ago with a porn star. Okay. I was on CNN with Aaron Burnett addressing this issue, and I would encourage you to go on and watch it. I think it was a fair exchange. But here's the point. A lot of the media has picked up a statement I made that the president, that evangelicals have given the president a mulligan. Not on this issue. Adultery is a serious issue, no matter who does it or where it's done. My point is, all of these things that we were concerned about with the president, we were aware of before the election. Most of us were not supporting him until it came down to a choice between him and Hillary Clinton. And then he said, look, give me a chance. I'm going to appoint pro-life justices. He wrapped himself in the most conservative party, values-oriented platform in history of the party, and he chose Mike Pence as his running mate. And he has surrounded himself with evangelicals and pledged to do differently. And from that standpoint, I said evangelicals understand change. They understand grace and the chance to do over. So, folks, as I said last night, our support is not unconditional to the president. But as long as he continues to be the most pro-life, pro-family president in terms of his policies and continues to walk the straight and narrow with the right influence, I don't care what they say, we're going to continue to support this administration. So before you listen to the headlines, go look at that interview. And by the way, get my update as well. We talk about these things. That way you'll be equipped to address the critics as well. All right, out of time. Thanks so much for being with us. Again, check out the website, TonyPerkins.com. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. Again, that's 1-866-372-7234. 372-7234.